Okay, welcome to the third session on Introduction to Stocks. And in this session, we will be discussing some common stock characteristics with quite a bit of information about dividends and a few other metrics, numeric measures that we use to evaluate stocks. Let's start on slide 61 with some common stock characteristics. Spin-offs, stock spin-offs. This is a conversion of one of a firm's subsidiaries to a standalone company by the distribution of stock in that new company to existing shareholders. Sometimes the new company is still majority owned by the company that spun it off. So here's an example. Kraft, right? World's second largest food company, was spun off from Altria, and that's the new name for Philip Morris. So Philip Morris, the cigarette company, owned Kraft for many years. They then spun them off. And why did they do this? Well, many people believe it's because there are just certain individual investors who will not ever invest in tobacco companies. And so they felt that there was some value, if you will, that was not being taken advantage of by investors who would invest in a food company, such as Kraft. So they spun it off. And Kraft has done okay. Altria then divested itself of its international tobacco business. So that is now called Philip Morris International. Now, why did they do that? I don't know, you'll have to ask them. But many people are far more excited about the prospects for Philip Morris International than they are for Altria. And why is that? Well, because Altria sells cigarettes in the United States. Is that a growth business? Not quite. But outside the United States? Yeah. Philip Morris is looking at China and Brazil and Russia and Eastern Europe and Latin America and South Africa and India and saying, we can sell there. By the way, Philip Morris International is based in the United States, so it's a domestic company that does all of its business outside the United States. Is it getting confusing? Yeah. Another example of a spinoff is Yum Brands. Huh? Who are they? Well, you do know them. And it's one of the companies I asked you to take a look at, optionally, for the earnings calls. You know them as Kentucky Fried Rat, pizza crap, and taco smell. I'm sorry, what are they called? I'm sorry. They used to be owned by Pepsi. Pepsi? The Coke, the cola company? Yeah, Pepsi. And that's why people compare Pepsi and Coca-Cola to one another, but really they're two different kind of companies. And you got it, folks. Outside the United States, they are doing really, really, really well. So think about the situation here. We are importing shoes and clothes and all oil and all everything, electronics that is manufactured, and we're exporting diabetes and lung cancer and heart disease. Continuing, slide 61. The history of spin-offs has been checkered. Some spin-offs have done better than the companies that spun them off. Example of this are the Baby Bells after being spun off from AT&T way back in 1984. AT&T essentially disappeared and was swallowed up by one of the Baby Bells, SBC Communications, which now calls itself AT&T, the new AT&T. Some spin-offs have not fared so well. Coca-Cola Enterprises, which was spun off from Coca-Cola. What's the difference? Well, Coca-Cola makes the syrup. They make the soda. Coca-Cola Enterprises is the bottling company. They actually bottle it and and send it all around the world. And Coca-Cola Enterprises really didn't do that well, and I think what's happened now is Coca-Cola has bought them back. And then Lucent Technologies, who are they? Well, that was the company that was used to be called Bell Labs and Western Electric. They were the that was the company that built the telephone equipment for AT&T. And they were spun off from the old AT&T. And even though they make the best telephone equipment in the world, they made some very bad business decisions. And they were also an example of a disappointment of spinoffs. So you may someday own a stock and then all of a sudden wind up with another stock as spinoff from that company. Slide 62. Stock splits. We don't hear as much about stock splits mostly because of technology, and we'll discuss that in a moment. But a stock split is a maneuver in which a company increases the number of shares outstanding by exchanging a specified number of new shares for each outstanding share. Huh? Well, it's actually very easy. For example, a 2-for-1 split. You had 100 shares, you now have 200 shares. Yippee! Thank you! Wow, this is a big deal. The price went from $20 down to $10. So you see, there's no real added value created. You still have the same amount of value. If you had 100 shares at $20, now you have 200 shares at $10. And there are 3-for-1 splits, 3-for-2 splits, 1-for-5 splits. That's called a reverse split, where you actually wind up with fewer shares, but the price goes up. And let's read at the bottom. There is no increased value from stock splits. If you had 1 share at 20, now you have 2 shares at 10. The value is still $20. It is a psychological increase at best. Now, Warren Buffett of Berkshire Hathaway fame, and we'll return to Mr. Buffett, has refused to split his stock since its inception back in the 1960s. He just believes it's accounting trickery. A single share now goes for around $120,000. Well, before the technology of electronics and the computers and telecommunications and the internet, there was a valid reason for stock splits. Because, if you remember, we wanted people to buy and sell stock in round lots, 100-share increments. So the stock price got quite large, quite high, it was hard for people to buy 100 shares. So the idea was to make it easier to do business in 100 shares. We don't need to do that anymore. Yeah, oddly, when they don't got people jumping up and down and screaming on the floor. It's all electronic. But folks, this is what would have happened to Coca-Cola or McDonald's or GE or any Clorox, any large company that's been around for decades. If they had never split their stock, one share would go for $80,000 or $120,000. Make sense? Yeah. Nowadays, what I think, and you have to ask them, but I think when a company splits its stock, it's a way of trying to tell the world, hey, we think things are doing okay for us. We think the future looks bright. Because they have to be careful about forward-looking statements. They have to be careful about actually saying, you know, by next year we're going to be doing just great. Because if it doesn't happen, they can get sued by the attack lawyers. So now what they do is they say, oh, we're going to split our stock. What does that mean? Well, you know, we're going to split our stock. And I think that's what Qualcomm did a few years ago. They split the stock for no apparent reason, but I think they were trying to tell people, hey, we think the future looks bright. And it turned out it was. They've been doing fairly well. So I think, I don't know, ask them. Slide number 63, Treasury stock. Not the United States Treasury. These are shares of stock that have been sold and subsequently repurchased by the issuing firm. Share buybacks are just called buybacks. Share buybacks reduce the number of outstanding shares of the stock. And you students of economics, if you reduce the supply and the demand doesn't change, what should happen to the price? Right, the price should go up. The logic being that after a buyback, there is less supply of outstanding stock. Existing shareholders now have a larger percentage ownership of the corporation. Yeah, capital gains. During the run-up of the 1990s, share buybacks were often seen as a better alternative to dividend increases. The belief was that investors were more interested in capital gains than dividends, and that buybacks increased the potential for capital gains by reducing the supply of stock. Okay, it makes sense, but you have to be careful. Sometimes companies buy back their shares when they're very expensive. That's not a very smart use of the cash. But often, when companies see that their stock price, for whatever reason, because the market as a whole has fallen, it's a bear market and people are terrified, or they just believe that their shares are undervalued, they will use cash to buy back their shares. And that's often a good thing to watch. It's often, not always, as I said, sometimes they do it at the worst possible time. But after the fall of 2008, early 2009, companies started buying back their shares in record numbers. The same thing happened back in 1987 after the Black Monday crash. And that is usually a very good sign because companies, I mean, they know more about themselves than anybody else, right? They're saying, hey, we're not going out of business. We're doing okay. Let's buy some of our own shares. And then they stick it in the treasury and those shares are no longer in circulation. Fewer shares. If the demand stays the same, smaller supply, the price should go up. But there's no guarantees. Slide 64, classifications of common stock. Some companies, usually the very large companies, have common stock issued in different classes, each of which whole offers different privileges and benefits to its holders. Some have higher dividends. Some have more voting rights. For a while there, GM had, I think, 7 different classes, A through G, I think. Berkshire Hathaway is one good example. Remember Warren Buffett? If you remember, his shares are selling for $120,000 each. Well, those are the Class A shares. Those were the original shares. In the early 90s, I think it was, the financial world pressed Warren Buffett to offer a lower cost version of his stock. And at their height or so, they sold for around $3,300 each. So you see they're about, you know, 1/100th or so. Not 1/100th, but 1/40th or so. In other words, they wanted to make it easier for smaller investors, in terms of money, to buy them. But he didn't want to do it. And in his prospectus, you know, the document you have to file when you create new shares of stock, he said he wouldn't buy them. He said, if you don't got the money to buy one share of Class A, then you shouldn't be buying my stock. He's kind of ornery. You know, he's the little curmudgeon. We use the word curmudgeon and a little bit cantankerous. And it turned out that Buffett made a good deal for himself with the Class B shares because when he buys another company with cash, you don't have to worry about the price of your shares. But when you buy another company with stock, it gets difficult if your stock is far more expensive than the company you're buying. So what they did is they split the B shares 40-1. So now he has a stock that sells for, you know, what often other stocks sell for, you know, anywhere from $40 to $100 or whatever. And so it's easier for him, for Berkshire Hathaway, he and Berkshire Hathaway, to use the Class B shares to buy other companies. So there. Slide number 65. Some common stock values. The par value. Well, this is the stated value of a stock, and it's fairly meaningless. I really don't understand it myself, but the accountants do. It reminds me of the coupons that you get for whatever you want to buy something at the store. What people would do is they would send a coupon in to Tide or whoever and say, oh, I want my 50 cents or my dollar cent or my dollar for this coupon. And the people would say, no, it doesn't work that way. You're supposed to take it and buy the Tide, and then the grocery store will give you 50 cents off, and then we'll give 50 cents at the grocery store. So what they started doing is on the back of the coupon, if you look there, it'll say cash value 0.01 cent or something. So you have to collect, 100,000 of them to get a dollar or something. And so it's just meaningless, yeah. So I think that's what, I don't know, ask a CPA. Book value. Now this is something more important, and we'll discuss this in more detail. Plus, it's one of the items I want you to look up in Chapter 5 research, the book value. This is the amount of the stockholder's equity in a firm. It equals the amount of the firm's asset minus the firm's liabilities and preferred stock, and we'll discuss that later on. So some of you accountants know what we're talking about, right? Equity. Assets minus liabilities equals equity. And when we look at it on a per share basis, that's the book value. And what you'll find is that's usually not on the front screen, the summary screen for stocks. So you have to go digging around under some statistics, key statistics, and then you'll find it. And then the market value is very simple. That's what people are paying for it. What are people bidding the price up to or down to at any one time? The prevailing market value of a security. In this case, we're discussing stocks. We'll discuss valuation in detail in Chapter 6. Slide 66, dividends. Okay, folks, we made mention of dividends several times. Let's take a look at them in detail, because as we learned, dividends don't lie. Yeah, right. Dividends are shares of the earnings given to stockholders, not shares in terms of more shares of stock, the distributions, the dollars. They used to write you a check, but they don't do that anymore. It's all electronic. In the United States and countries that originally were associated with the UK, England, United Kingdom, they normally pay quarterly. Okay? Outside the United States, they usually pay biannually, twice, is that right? Semi-annually, I'm sorry, biannually means every 2 years, semi-annually every 6 months, or some companies pay once a year, annually. But in the United States, sound like a tough question, companies pay quarterly. The board of directors decides how much, if any, dividends should be paid and when to pay them. They don't have to pay them, but as we've said, some companies have been paying dividends for over 100 years, folks. So, yeah, that's a pretty good track record, don't you think? Dividends are usually a percentage of the earnings per share, a very important number that we're going to look up and we're going to calculate, too. The amount of annual earnings available to common stockholders as stated on a per share basis. So in other words, I have one share of thingamabobs.com or widgets unlimited or Pepsi. Okay. How much is that share earning? And it's a very simple calculation, but it's even simpler to go online and look it up because it's public knowledge. Slide number 67. Here's an example. A company reports net profits of $1 million, and there are 500,000 shares outstanding. Well, earnings per share is $1 million of earnings divided, that's the divide symbol, by 500,000 shares, and that's $2 of earnings per share. Check it out on your calculator if you don't, just make sure I did it right. The board of directors might decide to pay 50% of the earnings per share in the form of dividends. Therefore, each shareholder would receive a dollar dividend for each share they owned. Right. That's why we say dividends don't lie, because you got a check. A dollar for every share you owned, and it's not a check anymore. They electronically deposit it into your account. This is called the dividend payout ratio. We divide the dividends by the earnings per share. The company is paying out 50% of their earnings to shareholders in the form of dividends. Is this typical? Well, for older, established, well-established companies, yeah, it might be. Usually it's a little less. And sometimes it's a little more. For example, utilities, yeah, they might pay out more because they're not growing. Slide 68, the dividend yield. Very important number. Another number that you're going to be researching. The dividend yield is a measure that relates dividends to the share price and puts stocks on a relative percentage basis rather than an absolute dollar basis. I mean, it's important to know what the amount of money you're getting per share, but more important is to be able to relate that that dollar per share to the price. In other words, what am I getting paid on a percentage basis? So let's continue the example. If the stock in the previous slide that was paying a dollar dividend were selling for $20, the dividend yield would be 5%. It's a very simple calculation. Here it is, a dollar dividend divided by $20, the market price, is 5%. This makes it easier to compare stocks with other income-oriented vehicles such as bonds or savings accounts. And as we said, traditionally 3 to 6% was normal. In the 1980s and 1990s run-up, dividends went to 2% or less. At the peak in March of 2000, they were 1%. Dividends went above 3% in the 2008-2009 turmoil, and now are back to about 2%. But some companies are paying a lot more, and some companies are not paying any dividends. And why is that? Well, some companies are growth companies, and they need the money to reinvest in the company, and some companies are more mature, and they are already going through their growth spurt, and we'll discuss different types of companies in the next presentation. Slide number 69. Very important dates regarding dividends. And here's where there's a little bit of confusion, so let's get these down. Slide 69, the declaration date. Well, this is the date the board of directors declares a dividend. We will pay a dividend, and this is how much it is. But that's not for a while. In fact, that date is the date of record, the date on which an investor must be a registered shareholder of a firm to be entitled to receive a dividend. Okay, so it's whatever the date is. We have to buy the stock by that day, right? Wrong. There's the ex-dividend date. That's 3 business days before the date of record. What? This determines whether one is an official shareholder of a firm and thus eligible to receive a declared dividend. Why is that? Because stocks clear in 3 business days. So you buy a stock today, you don't actually get the stock for 3 business days. And the same thing is true when you sell a stock. You sell it today, you don't get the money for 3 days. Now, most of the brokerage firms will give you the money and they'll just, you know, they might charge you a few pennies for interest because they're saying, you know, you really don't have the money for 3 days, but we'll lend it to you because, you know, you're a good guy. And then the payment date is the actual date on which the company pays the dividend. So let's take a look at an example on slide 70. I'm sorry, not yet. We have to... Yeah, we're taking a look at an example here. Why is the ex-dividend date 3 days before the date of record? Because, as we said, stock transactions close in 3 days. If you purchase a stock on June 15th, for example, you don't actually get the stock until June 18th. Assuming that June 15th were a Monday or a Tuesday, what happens if it were a Thursday? Right, exactly. You go one business day, Friday, and then you skip the weekend, and then Monday, Tuesday. So you wouldn't get it until Tuesday. You understand? Theoretically, now this is theoretically, it never happens in real life, the opening share price on the ex-dividend date should reflect a drop in price commensurate with the amount of the dividend. Why? Because they're taking a dollar out of the company and sending it to the shareholders. So if the if there is a $1 per share dividend, the opening stock price should theoretically be reduced by $1. Well, no, it never really works out that way because the prices are changing all the time, right? So unless it were a large dividend distribution, it never works that way in real life. But you have to understand ex-dividend date and the date of record and the ex-dividend date. That's 3 days before the date of record. Slide number 71. Now, here's a common industry in the common saying in the industry, which I hope you will ignore. Don't buy the dividend. Translation: you are often better off waiting until the ex-dividend date before buying a stock. And here's the logic. Dividends are taxable transactions. If you buy the dividend, you buy the stock just before the ex-dividend date, you will be responsible for paying the tax, and presumably the stock price will fall commensurate with the amount of the dividend, but it really never does. And so you are better off waiting until after the ex-dividend date so that you will get the stock at a better price and not generate a taxable transaction. Well, folks, for most of us working grunts who are putting in a couple thousand dollars at a time, it's not a big deal. It's just not a big deal. If you have a very large sum of money and you're about ready to make a huge purchase, well, okay, I guess it makes some sense. And the same kind of thing happens with mutual funds to some extent. At the end of the year, normally, mutual funds declare their capital gains for the year. And so if you are ready to make a large investment into mutual funds, I mean, you know, several thousand, tens of thousands of dollars, then it sort of makes sense to wait until they declare the dividends, declare the capital gains. Because if there are significant capital gains, you're going to put the money in, say, in November 30th, December 10th, they pay you a good chunk of change in the form of capital gains and dividends, but they, of course, reinvest it back into the mutual fund. But you still get a 1099 the next year for that year's taxes and have to pay taxes, and you just bought the darn thing. So it's something to be aware of, but only when you have large sums of money. For most of us grunts putting money in every month into a Roth IRA or a 401k, it doesn't matter because it's a tax-qualified account. You don't pay taxes until you take the money out. If it's a Roth, you don't ever pay taxes. So, yeah, you have to be aware of it, but for most of us, it's not important, not something we have to worry about. Slide 72, types of dividends. Now, this is something we have to worry about. Please note this important difference. There are two types of dividends. There are cash dividends that are payments of dividends in the form of cash, and those are good. So we should have a little thing saying good, or maybe a little angel here. And then there are stock dividends, which is payment of a dividend in the form of additional shares of stock. And here should be the little word that says bad dividends. The good dividends, cash dividends, the bad dividends, stock dividends. Or maybe a little devil or something, I don't know. All else being equal, stock dividends have no value because they constitute a dilution of ownership. It's like a stock split, folks. They're really not giving you anything. The board of directors declares a 10% stock dividend, for example. For each 10 shares, you receive one extra share. Yippee! Well, correspondingly, the price of the shares dropped 10%. Boo! But, unlike a cash dividend, a stock dividend is not taxed anyway. Well, no taxes. Big deal. I'm very glad you're not taxing me on something that's worthless. It's not worth anything, so I'm glad the IRS doesn't say, we're going to tax you on something that's not worth anything. So if you are tempted by someone who says, oh, this stock is paying tremendous dividends, what kind of dividends? Stock dividends, you're going to get 15% a year. And you say, well, you're not really giving me anything because, yeah, you understand. But you get more shares. but they'll be worth the same amount. Slide 73. Now, there are what we call dividend reinvestment plans. And these are very cool, folks. These are very cool. They also have a great name, DRIPs. Isn't that what you want? A DRIP? Well, depending on what type of investor you are, yeah, it's like having a mutual fund. Because what happens is your dividends, your cash dividends, not your stock dividends, are automatically reinvested into additional shares of the firm's common stock. This is a taxable transaction because there's no additional shares that were issued, hence no dilution of ownership occurred. So how does this work? You go to a company, usually large companies that are well established, and say, you know what, I'm interested in buying your shares, but I want them to be automatically reinvested. And they'll say, oh yeah, here, check out this website. We have a dividend reinvestment plan. And of course, they don't run it. Some other company runs it for them. But that company, when they issue you cash dividends, will go out and buy more shares of their stock and give them to you in the form of reinvested dividends. And this is what mutual funds do all the time, right? So in this way, it's a way to buy a stock and treat it like a mutual fund. So let's read at the bottom. DRIPs are an excellent way to own stock for those interested in long-term growth and not interested in the current income. They don't need the dividends. It allows the investor to take advantage of compounding automatically with normally no or very, very tiny transaction costs. Investing in a company like General Electric or Johnson & Johnson in this way is almost like investing in a mutual fund because these companies are so incredibly diversified. It's like getting in a mutual fund. On the class website is an example of SDG&E, Sempra, the parent company of SDG&E, and a dividend reinvestment plan. So, and of course, there's a commentary, so I want you to take a look at that. This is where I would where we would discuss that in the face-to-face class. Cool? Yeah. And now, because of their popularity, most brokerage firms will allow you to automatically reinvest your dividends. They didn't want to do that before. They just wanted to give you the cash, but now they see that these things are very popular with people. And there's one or two brokerage firms basically that specialize in these. One's called ShareBuilder, right? ShareBuilder, and the other one is Better Investing. It used to be the National Association of Investors Corporation, the NAIC, but they've changed their name to Better Investing. I liked NAIC a whole lot better. But anyway, check them out. I think for $10 a month, they'll let you put all your DRIPs in one place, which is good because, folks, if you have 12 different companies, you get 12 different statements. Yeah, it's not a big deal, but it's an issue. Slide number 74, price to earnings ratio, PE. Oh boy, does this puppy open a whole can of worms. In fact, we've already seen this, didn't we? We made mention of this back in chapter 4 about high PE, low PE. This statistic is, I think I can reasonably say that it's the most watched statistic about stocks individually and the stock market as a whole. The price of the stock divided by the earnings per share. So again, it's a relatively straightforward calculation. So our example, we had a $20 stock price, $2 of earnings per share. So we take $20 divided by $20 price divided by $2 in earnings, and we get 10. Now, don't put a dollar sign, don't put a percent sign. It is a unitless measurement. So you don't put a dollar sign or percent sign or anything. Traditionally, stocks sold for PE ratios of 5 to 14, and a price to earnings ratio of 20 was only reserved for the fastest growing stocks. But for many years, not just in the 80s and 90s, but for many years in the 80s and 90s, and then other times before that in the 60s and in the 20s, a PE of 20 was not unusual. And in the 2008-2009 turmoil, PE ratios came down dramatically. We are going to spend a great deal of time learning about price-to-earnings ratio, the PE, and other valuation techniques in the next few chapters. PE is also one of the things I asked you to research. You don't even have to do the calculation, because when you look up a stock, it gives you the PE. And, you know, very quickly we're going to go over it again, but the price-to-earnings ratio signifies what investors believe the future for the company is. The higher the PE, the more optimistic, in general, now there's lots of nuances involved, but in general, the higher the PE, the more optimistic investors are about the future for the company. The lower the PE, the less optimistic they are. Now, are they right? We will know in 4 or 5 years, right? But for now, you look at a PE and you say, oh, wow, that's a high PE, 30. People really think that company's going to do well. Or that's a PE of 6? Ugh, I don't think this company's going to grow very fast in the future. And that's just the beginning of how many different ways PE can be interpreted. So relax, breathe deeply, and we will discuss this in detail later on. For now, all you have to do is go look it up. Okay, so go back over these characteristics, and especially the information about dividends, because dividends don't lie. And when we come together again, we'll be in our last session, and we'll discuss the different types of stocks and market capitalization, which is a fancy term for how big the company is. See you next time.